someone canceled or didn't show. She and Roosevelt worked 4 hours each day and were paid $1,000 each month. Mitch sat at a table with Lamar Quinn, Oliver Lambert, and Royce McKnight. The entree was prime rib, served with fried okra and boiled squash. "She laid off the grease today," Mr. Lambert observed. "It's delicious," Mitch said. "Is your system accustomed to grease?" "Yes. They cook this way in Kentucky." "I joined this firm in 1955," Mr. McKnight said, "and I come from New Jersey, right? Out of suspicion, I avoided most southern dishes as much as possible. Everything is battered and fried in animal fat, right? Then Mr. Bendini decides to open up this little cafe. He hires Jesse Francis, and I've had heartburn for the past 20 years. Fried ripe tomatoes, fried green tomatoes, fried eggplant, fried okra, fried squash, fried anything and everything." One day, Victor Milligan said too much. He's from Connecticut, right? And Jesse Francis had whipped up a batch of fried dill pickles. Can you imagine? Fried dill pickles? Milligan said something ugly to Roosevelt, and he reported it to Jesse Francis. She walked out the back door and quit. Stayed gone for a week. Roosevelt wanted to work, but she kept him at home. Finally, Mr. Bendini smoothed things over, and she agreed to return if there were no complaints. But she also cut back on the grease. "I think we'll all live 10 years longer." "It's delicious," said Lamar as he buttered another roll. "It's always delicious," added Mr. Lambert as Roosevelt walked by. "Her food is rich and fattening, but we seldom miss lunch." Mitch ate cautiously, engaged in nervous chit-chat, and tried to appear completely at ease. It was difficult. Surrounded by eminently successful lawyers, all millionaires in their exclusive, lavishly ornamented dining suite, he felt as if he was on hallowed ground. Lamar's presence was comforting, as was Roosevelt's. When it was apparent Mitch had finished eating, Oliver Lambert wiped his mouth, rose slowly, and tapped his tea glass with his spoon. "Gentlemen, could I have your attention?" The room became silent as the 20 or so partners turned to the head table. They laid their napkins down and stared at the guest. Somewhere on each of their desks was a copy of the dossier. 2 months earlier, they had voted unanimously to make him their number one pick. They knew he ran 4 miles a day, did not smoke, was allergic to sulfites, had no tonsils, had a blue Mazda, had a crazy mother, and once threw 3 interceptions in 1 quarter. They knew he took nothing stronger than aspirin, even when he was sick, and that he was hungry enough to work 100 hours a week, if they asked. They liked him. He was good-looking, athletic-looking, a man's man with a brilliant mind and a lean body. "As you know, we have a very special guest today, Mitch McDear. He will soon graduate with honors from Harvard." "Hear, hear," said a couple of Harvard alumni. "Yes, thank you. He and his wife Abby are staying at the Peabody this weekend as our guests. Mitch will finish in the top 5 out of 300 and has been heavily recruited. We want him here, and I know you will speak to him before he leaves. Tonight, he will have dinner with Lamar and Kay Quinn, and then tomorrow night is the dinner at my place. You are all expected to attend." Mitch smiled awkwardly at the partners as Mr. Lambert rambled on about the greatness of the firm. When he finished, they continued eating as Roosevelt served bread pudding and coffee. Kay's favorite restaurant was a chic East Memphis hangout for the young affluent. 1,000 ferns hung from everywhere, and the jukebox played nothing but early 60s. The daiquiris were served in tall souvenir glasses. "One is enough," Kay warned. "I'm not much of a drinker." They ordered the quiche of the day and sipped daiquiris. "Does Mitch drink?" "Very little. He's an athlete and very particular about his body. An occasional beer or a glass of wine. Nothing stronger."
"How about Lamar?"
"About the same. He really discovered beer in law school, but he has trouble with his weight. The firm frowns on drinking."
"That's admirable, but why is it their business?"
"Because alcohol and lawyers go together like blood and vampires. Most lawyers drink like fish, and the profession is plagued with alcoholism. I think it starts in law school. At Vanderbilt, someone was always tapping a keg of beer. Probably the same at Harvard. The job has a lot of pressure, and that usually means a lot of booze. These guys aren't a bunch of teetotalers, mind you, but they keep it under control. A healthy lawyer is a productive lawyer. Again, profits."
"I guess that makes sense. Mitch says there's no turnover."
"It's rather permanent. I can't recall anyone leaving in the 7 years we've been here. The money's great, and they're careful about whom they hire. They don't want anyone with family money."
"I'm not sure I follow."
"They won't hire a lawyer with other sources of income. They want them young and hungry. It's a question of loyalty. If all your money comes from one source, then you tend to be very loyal to that source. The firm demands extreme loyalty. Lamar says there's never talk of leaving. They are all happy, and either rich or getting that way. And if one wanted to leave, he couldn't find as much money with another firm. They'll offer Mitch whatever it takes to get you down here. They take pride in paying more."
"Why no female lawyers?"
"They tried it once. She was a real bitch and kept the place in an uproar. Most women lawyers walk around with chips on their shoulders looking for fights. They're hard to deal with. Lamar says they're afraid to hire one because they couldn't fire her if she didn't work out, with affirmative action and all." The quiche arrived, and they declined another round of daiquiris. Hundreds of young professionals crowded under the clouds of ferns, and the restaurant grew festive. Smokey Robinson sang softly from the jukebox.
"I've got a great idea," Kay said. "I know a realtor. Let's call her and go look at some houses."
"What kind of houses?"
"For you and Mitch.
For the newest associate at Bendini, Lambert, and Locke. She can show you several in your price range."
"I don't know her price range."
"I'd say $100,000 to $150,000. The last associate bought in Oak Grove, and I'm sure he paid something like that." Abby leaned forward and almost whispered,
"How much would the monthly payments be?"
"I don't know. But you'll be able to afford it. Around $1,000 a month, maybe a little more." Abby stared at her and swallowed hard. The small apartments in Manhattan were renting for twice that.
"Let's give her a call."
As expected, Royce McKnight's office was a power one with a great view. It was in one of the prized corners on the fourth floor, down the hall from Nathan Locke. Lamar excused himself, and the managing partner asked Mitch to have a seat at a small conference table next to the sofa. A secretary was sent for coffee. McKnight asked him about his visit so far, and Mitch said he was quite impressed. "Mitch, I want to nail down the specifics of our offer."
"Certainly."
"The base salary is $80,000 for the first year. When you pass the bar exam, you receive a $5,000 raise. Not a bonus, but a raise. The exam is given sometime in August, and you'll spend most of your summer reviewing for it.
We have our own bar study courses, and you'll receive extensive tutoring from some of the partners. This is done primarily on firm time. As you know, most firms put you to work and expect you to study on your own time. Not us. No associate of this firm has ever flunked the bar exam, and we're not worried about you breaking with tradition. 80,000 initially, up to 85 in 6 months. Once you've been here a year, you'll be raised to 90,000, plus you'll get a bonus each December based on the profits and performance during the prior 12 months. Last year, the average bonus for associates was 9,000. As you know, profit sharing with associates is extremely rare for law firms. Any questions about the salary? What happens after the second year? Your base salary is raised about 10% a year until you become a partner. Neither the raises nor the bonuses are guaranteed. They're based on performance. Fair enough. As you know, it is very important to us that you buy a home. It adds stability and prestige, and we're very concerned about these things, especially with our associates. The firm provides a low-interest mortgage loan, 30 years, fixed rate, non-assumable should you decide to sell in a few years. It's a one-shot deal, available only for your first home. After that, you're on your own. What kind of rate? As low as possible without running afoul with the IRS. Current market rate is around 10.5. We should be able to get you a rate of 7-8%. We represent some banks, and they assist us. With this salary, you will have no trouble qualifying. In fact, the firm will sign on as a guarantor if necessary. That's very generous, Mr. McKnight. It's important to us. And we don't lose any money on the deal. Once you find a house, our real estate section handles everything. All you have to do is move in. What about the BMW? Mr. McKnight chuckled. We started that about 10 years ago, and it's proved to be quite an inducement. It's very simple. You pick out a BMW, one of the smaller ones. We lease it for 3 years and give you the keys. We pay for tags, insurance, maintenance. At the end of 3 years, you can buy it from the leasing company for the fair market value. It's also a one-shot deal. That's very tempting. We know. Mr. McKnight looked at his legal pad. We provide complete medical and dental coverage for the entire family. Pregnancies, checkups, braces, everything. Paid entirely by the firm. Mitch nodded, but was not impressed. This was standard. We have a retirement plan, second to none. For every dollar you invest, the firm matches it with two, provided, however, you invest at least 10% of your base pay. Let's say you start at 80, and the first year you set aside 8,000. The firm kicks in 16, so you've got 24 after the first year. A money pro in New York handles it, and last year our retirement earned 19%. Not bad. Invest for 20 years and you're a millionaire at 45, just off retirement. One stipulation. If you bail out before 20 years, you lose everything but the money you put in, with no income earned on that money. Sounds rather harsh. No, actually, it's rather generous. Find me another firm or company matching 2-1. There are none, to my knowledge. It's our way of taking care of ourselves. Many of our partners retire at 50, some at 45. We have no mandatory retirement, and some work into their 60s and 70s. To each his own. Our goal is simply to ensure a generous pension and make early retirement an option. How many retired partners do you have? 20 or so. You'll see them around here from time to time. They like to come in and have lunch, and a few keep office space. Did Lamar cover vacations?
Yes.
Good. Book early, especially for Vale and the Caymans. You buy the airfare, but the condos are free. We do a lot of business in the Caymans, and from time to time we'll send you down for 2 or 3 days and write the whole thing off. Those trips are not counted as vacation, and you'll get one every year or so. We work hard, Mitch, and we recognize the value of leisure. Mitch nodded his approval and dreamed of lying on a sun-drenched beach in the Caribbean, sipping on a piña colada and watching string bikinis. Did Lamar mention the signing bonus?
No, but it sounds interesting.
If you join our firm, we hand you a check for $5,000. We prefer that you spend the bulk of it on a new wardrobe. After 7 years of jeans and flannel shirts, your inventory of suits is probably low, and we realize it. Appearance is very important to us. We expect our attorneys to dress sharp and conservative. There's no dress code, but you'll get the picture.
Did he say $5,000? For clothes?
Mitch currently owned 2 suits, and he was wearing one of them. He kept a straight face and did not smile.
Any questions?
Yes. The large firms are infamous for being sweatshops where the associates are flooded with tedious research and locked away in some library for the first 3 years. I want no part of that. I don't mind doing my share of research, and I realize I will be the low man on the pole. But I don't want to research and write briefs for the entire firm. I'd like to work with real clients and their real problems.
Mr. McKnight listened intently and waited with his rehearsed answer.
I understand, Mitch. You're right. It is a real problem in the big firms. But not here. For the first 3 months, you'll do little but study for the bar exam. When that's over, you begin practicing law. You'll be assigned to a partner, and his clients will become your clients. You'll do most of his research, and of course your own, and occasionally you'll be asked to assist someone else with the preparation of a brief or some research. We want you happy. We take pride in our zero turnover rate, and we go the extra mile to keep careers on track. If you can't get along with your partner, we'll find another one. If you discover you don't like tax, we'll let you try securities or banking. It's your decision. The firm will soon invest a lot of money in Mitch McDear, and we want him to be productive.
Mitch sipped his coffee and searched for another question.
Mr. McKnight glanced at his checklist. We pay all moving expenses to Memphis.
That won't be much. Just a small rental truck.
Anything else, Mitch?
No, sir. I can't think of anything.
The checklist was folded and placed in the file. The partner rested both elbows on the table and leaned forward.
Mitch, we're not pushing, but we need an answer as soon as possible. If you go elsewhere, we must then continue to interview. It's a lengthy process, and we'd like our new man to start by July 1st.
10 days, soon enough.
That's fine.
Say by March 30th.
Sure, but I'll contact you before then.
Mitch excused himself and found Lamar waiting in the hall outside McKnight's office. They agreed on 7 for dinner.
Chapter 3. There were no law offices on the 5th floor of the Bandini building. The partner's dining room and kitchen occupied the west end. Some unused and unpainted storage rooms sat locked and empty in the center. Then a thick
concrete wall sealed off the remaining third of the floor. A small metal door with a button beside it and a camera over it hung in the center of the wall and opened into a small room where an armed guard watched the door and monitored a wall of closed-circuit screens. A hallway zigzagged through a maze of cramped offices and workrooms where an assortment of characters went secretly about their business of watching and gathering information. The windows to the outside were sealed with paint and covered with blinds. The sunlight stood no chance of penetrating the fortress. Devasher, head of security, occupied the largest of the small, plain offices. The loan certificate on his bare walls recognized him for 30 years of dedicated service as a detective with the New Orleans Police Department. He was stocky, with a slight belly, thick shoulders and chest, and a huge, perfectly round head that smiled with great reluctance. His wrinkled shirt was mercifully unbuttoned at the collar, allowing his bulging neck to sag unrestricted. A thick polyester tie hung on the coat rack with a badly worn blazer. Monday morning after the McDear visit, Oliver Lambert stood before the small metal door and stared at the camera over it. He pushed the button twice, waited, and was finally cleared through security. He walked quickly through the cramped hallway and entered the cluttered office. Devasher blew smoke from a Dutch Masters into a smokeless ashtray and shoved papers in all directions until wood was visible on his desk.
"Morning, Ollie. I guess you want to talk about McDear."
Devasher was the only person in the Bendini building who called him Ollie to his face.
"Yes, among other things." "Well, he had a good time, was impressed with the firm, liked Memphis okay, and will probably sign on."
"Where were your people?"
"We had the rooms on both sides at the hotel. His room was wired, of course, as was the limo and the phone and everything else. The usual, Ollie."
"Let's get specific."
"Okay. Thursday night they checked in late and went to bed. Little discussion. Friday night he told her all about the firm, the offices, the people. Said you were a real nice man. I thought you'd like that.
Get on with it."
"Told her about the fancy dining room and his little lunch with the partners. Gave her the specifics on the offer, and they were ecstatic. Much better than his other offers. She wants a home with a driveway and a sidewalk and trees and a backyard. He said she could have one."
"Any problems with the firm?"
"Not really. He commented on the absence of blacks and women, but it didn't seem to bother him."
"What about his wife?"
"She had a ball. She likes the town, and she and Quinn's wife hit it off. They looked at houses Friday afternoon, and she saw a couple she liked."
"You get any addresses?"
"Of course, Ollie. Saturday morning they called the limo and rode all over town. Very impressed with the limo. Our driver stayed away from the bad sections, and they looked at more houses. I think they decided on one. 1231 East Meadowbrook. It's empty. Realtor by the name of Betsy Bell walked them through it. Asking 140, but we'll take less. Need to move it."
"That's a nice part of town. How old is the house?"
10-15 years. 3,000 square feet. Sort of a colonial-looking job. It's nice enough for one of your boys, Ollie."
"Are you sure that's the one they want?"
"For now, anyway. They discussed maybe coming back in a month or so to look at some more. You might want to fly them back as soon as they accept."
"Well, that's normal procedure, ain't it?"
"Yes, we'll handle that. What about the salary?"
"Most impressed.
Highest one so far. They talked and talked about the money. Salary, retirement, mortgage, BMW, bonus, everything. They couldn't believe it. Kids must really be broke.
They are.
You think we got him, huh?
I'd bet on it. He said once that the firm may not be as prestigious as the ones on Wall Street, but the lawyers were just as qualified and a lot nicer. I think he'll sign on.
Yeah. Any suspicions?
Not really. Quinn evidently told him to stay away from Locke's office. He told his wife that no one ever went in there but some secretaries and a handful of partners. But he said Quinn said Locke was eccentric and not that friendly. I don't think he's suspicious, though. She said the firm seemed concerned about some things that were none of its business.
Such as?
Personal matters? Children? Working wives, etc.? She seemed a bit irritated, but I think it was more of an observation. She told Mitch Saturday morning that she would be damned if any bunch of lawyers would tell her when to work and when to have babies. But I don't think it's a problem.
Does he realize how permanent this place is?
I think so. There was no mention of putting in a few years and moving on. I think he got the message. He wants to be a partner, like all of them. He's broke and wants the money.
What about the dinner at my place?
They were nervous, but had a good time. Very impressed with your place. Really liked your wife.
Sex?
Every night. Sounded like a honeymoon in there.
What did they do?
We couldn't see, remember? Sounded normal. Nothing kinky. I thought of you and how much you like pictures, and I kept telling myself we should have rigged up some cameras for old Ollie.
Shut up, Devasher.
Maybe next time.
They were silent as Devasher looked at a notepad. He stubbed his cigar in the ashtray and smiled to himself.
All in all, he said, it's a strong marriage. They seem to be very intimate. Your driver said they held hands all weekend. Not a cross word for 3 days.
That's pretty good, ain't it?
But who am I? I've been married 3 times myself.
That's understandable. What about children?
Couple of years. She wants to work some, then get pregnant.
What's your opinion of this guy?
Very good, very decent young man. Also very ambitious. I think he's driven, and he won't quit until he's at the top. He'll take some chances, bend some rules if necessary.
Ollie smiled. That's what I wanted to hear.
2 phone calls, both to her mother in Kentucky. Nothing remarkable.
What about his family?
Never mentioned.
No word on Ray?
We're still looking, Ollie. Give us some time.
Devasher closed the McDear file and opened another, much thicker one. Lambert rubbed his temples and stared at the floor.
What's the latest? He asked softly.
It's not good, Ollie. I'm convinced Hodge and Kaczynski are working together now.
Last week the FBI got a warrant and checked Kaczynski's house. Found our wiretaps. They told him his house was bugged, but of course they don't know who did it. Kaczynski tells Hodge last Friday while they're hiding in the 3rd floor library. We got a bug nearby, and we pick up bits and pieces. Not much, but we know they talked about the wiretaps. They're convinced everything is bugged, and they suspect us. They're very careful where they talk.
Why would the FBI bother with a search warrant?
Good question. Probably for our benefit. To make things look real legal and proper. They respect us.
Which agent?
Terrence. He's in charge, evidently.
Is he good?
He's okay. Young, green, overzealous, but competent. He's no match for our men.
How often has he talked to Kaczynski?
There's no way to know. They figure we're listening, so everybody's real careful. We know of 4 meetings in the last month, but I suspect more.
How much has he spilled?
Not much, I hope. They're still shadowboxing. The last conversation we got was a week ago, and he didn't say much. He's bad scared. They're coaxing a lot, but not getting much. He hasn't yet made the decision to cooperate. They approached him, remember? At least we think they approached him. They shook him up pretty bad, and he was ready to cut a deal. Now he's having second thoughts. But he's still in contact with them, and that's what worries me.
Does his wife know?
I don't think so. She knows he's acting strange, and he tells her it's office pressure.
What about Hodge?
Still ain't talked to the Phibbies, as far as we know. He and Kaczynski talk a lot, or whisper, I should say. Hodge keeps saying he's scared to death of the FBI, that they don't play fair, and they cheat and play dirty. He won't move without Kaczynski.
What if Kaczynski is eliminated?
Hodge will be a new man. But I don't think we've reached that point. Damn it, Ollie, he ain't some hotshot thug who gets in the way. He's a very nice young man, with kids and all that.
Your compassion is overwhelming.
I guess you think I enjoy this. Hell, I practically raised these boys. Well, get them back in line, then, before this thing goes too far.
New York's getting suspicious, Ollie. They're asking a lot of questions.
Who?
Lazarov?
What have you told them, Devasher?
Everything. That's my job. They want you in New York day after tomorrow for a full briefing.
What do they want?
Answers.
And plans.
Plans for what?
Preliminary plans to eliminate Kaczynski, Hodge, and Terrence, should it become necessary.
Terrence? Are you crazy, Devasher? We can't eliminate a cop. They'll send in the troops.
Lazarov is stupid, Ollie. You know that.
He's an idiot, but I don't think we should tell him.
I think I will. I think I'll go to New York and tell Lazarov he's a complete fool.
You do that, Ollie. You do that.
Oliver Lambert jumped from his seat and headed for the door.
Watch McDear for another month.
Sure, Ollie. You betcha.
He'll sign.
Don't worry.
Chapter 4. The Mazda was sold for $200, and most of the money was immediately invested in a 12-foot U-Haul rental truck. He would be reimbursed in Memphis. Half of the odd assortment of furniture was given or thrown away, and when loaded, the truck held a refrigerator, a bed, a dresser and chest of drawers, a small color television, boxes of dishes, clothes and junk, and an old sofa which was taken out of sentiment and would not last long in the new location. Abby held Hearsay, the mutt, as Mitch worked his way through Boston and headed south, far south, toward the promise of better things. For 3 days they drove the back roads, enjoyed the countryside, sang along with the radio, slept in cheap motels and talked of the house, the BMW, new furniture, children, affluence. They rolled down the windows and let the wind blow as the truck approached top speeds of almost 45 miles per hour. At one point, somewhere in Pennsylvania, Abby mentioned that perhaps they could stop in Kentucky for a brief visit. Mitch said nothing, but chose a route through the Carolinas and Georgia, never venturing within 200 miles of any point on the Kentucky border. Abby let it pass. They arrived in Memphis on a Thursday morning, and as promised, the black 318i sat under the carport as though it belonged there. He stared at the car.
She stared at the house. The lawn was thick, green, and neatly trimmed. The hedges had been manicured. The marigolds were in bloom. The keys were found under a bucket in the utility room, as promised. After the first test drive, they quickly unloaded the truck before the neighbors could inspect the sparse belongings. The U-Haul was returned to the nearest dealer. Another test drive. An interior designer, the same one who would do his office, arrived after noon and brought with her samples of carpet, paint, floor coverings, curtains, drapes, wallpaper. Abby found the idea of a designer a bit hilarious after their apartment in Cambridge, but played along. Mitch was immediately bored and excused himself for another test drive. He toured the tree-lined, quiet, shady streets of this handsome neighborhood, of which he was now a member. He smiled as boys on bicycles stopped and whistled at his new car. He waved at the postman walking down the sidewalk, sweating profusely. Here he was, Mitchell Y. McDear, 25 years old and 1 week out of law school, and he had arrived. At three, they followed the designer to an upscale furniture store where the manager politely informed them that Mr. Oliver Lambert had already made arrangements for their credit, if they so chose, and there was, in fact, no limit on what they could buy and finance. They bought a houseful. Mitch frowned from time to time and twice vetoed items as too expensive, but Abby ruled the day. The designer complimented her time and again on her marvelous taste and said she would see Mitch on Monday to do his office. Marvelous, he said. With a map of the city, they set out for the Quinn residence. Abby had seen the house during the first visit but did not remember how to find it. It was in a section of town called Chickasaw Gardens, and she remembered the wooded lots, huge houses, and professionally landscaped front yards. They parked in the driveway behind the new Mercedes and the old Mercedes. The maid nodded politely, but did not smile. She led them to the living room and left them. The house was dark and quiet. No children, no voices, no one. They admired the furniture and waited. They mumbled quietly, then grew impatient. Yes, they agreed. They had, in fact, been invited to dinner on this night, Thursday, June 25th at 6 p.m. Mitch checked his watch again and said something about it being rude. They waited. From the hallway, Kay emerged and attempted to smile. Her eyes were puffy and glazed, with mascara leaking from the corners. Tears flowed freely down her cheeks, and she held a handkerchief over her mouth. She hugged Abby and sat next to her on the sofa. She bit the handkerchief and cried louder. Mitch knelt before her. "Kay, what's happened?" She bit harder and shook her head. Abby squeezed her knee, and Mitch patted the other one. They watched her fearfully, expecting the worst. Was it Lamar? Or one of the kids?
There's been a tragedy, she said through the quiet sobbing.
Who is it? Mitch asked. She wiped her eyes and breathed deeply.
Two members of the firm, Marty Kaczynski and Joe Hodge, were killed today. We were very close to them.
Mitch sat on the coffee table. He remembered Marty Kaczynski from the second visit in April. He had joined Lamar and Mitch for lunch at a deli on Front Street. He was next in line for a partnership, but had seemed less than enthused. Mitch could not place Joe Hodge. "What happened?" he asked. She had stopped crying, but the tears continued. She wiped her face again and looked at him.
"We're not sure. They were on Grand Cayman, scuba diving. There was some kind of an explosion on a boat, and we think they drowned. Lamar said details were sketchy. There was a firm meeting a few hours ago, and they were all told about it. Lamar barely made it home.
Where is he?
By the pool. He's waiting for you.
He sat in a white metal lawn chair next to a small table with a small umbrella a few feet from the edge of the pool. Near a flowerbed, a circular lawn sprinkler rattled and hissed and spewed forth water in a perfect arc which included the table, umbrella, chair, and Lamar Quinn. He was soaked. Water dripped from his nose, ears, and hair. The blue cotton shirt and wool pants were saturated. He wore no socks or shoes. He sat motionless, never flinching with each additional dousing. He had lost touch. Some distant object on the side fence attracted and held his attention. An unopened bottle of Heineken sat in a puddle on the concrete beside his chair. Mitch surveyed the back lawn, in part to make sure the neighbors could not see. They could not. An 8-foot cypress fence ensured complete privacy. He walked around the pool and stopped at the edge of the dry area. Lamar noticed him, nodded, attempted a weak smile, and motioned to a wet chair. Mitch pulled it a few feet away and sat down, just as the next barrage of water landed. His stare returned to the fence, or whatever it was in the distance. For an eternity they sat and listened to the thrashing sound of the sprinkler. Lamar would sometimes shake his head and attempt to mumble. Mitch smiled awkwardly, unsure of what, if anything, needed to be said. "Lamar, I'm very sorry," he finally offered. He acknowledged this and looked at Mitch.
"Me too.
I wish I could say something."
His eyes left the fence and he cocked his head sideways in Mitch's direction. His dark hair was soaked and hung in his eyes. The eyes were red and pained. He stared and waited until the next round of water passed over.
"I know. But there's nothing to say. I'm sorry it had to happen now, today. We didn't feel like cooking.
But that should be the least of your concern. I lost my appetite a moment ago."
"Do you remember them?" he asked, blowing water from his lips.
"I remember Kaczynski, but not Hodge."
"Marty Kaczynski was one of my best friends from Chicago. He joined the firm 3 years ahead of me and was next in line for a partnership. A great lawyer, one we all admired and turned to. Probably the best negotiator in the firm. Very cool and dry under pressure."
He wiped his eyebrows and stared at the ground. When he talked, the water dripped from his nose and interfered with his enunciation.
"Three kids. His twin girls are a month older than our son, and they have always played together."
He closed his eyes, bit his lip, and started crying. Mitch wanted to leave. He tried not to look at his friend.
"I'm very sorry, Lamar. Very sorry."
After a few minutes, the crying stopped, but the water continued. Mitch surveyed the spacious lawn in search of the outside faucet. Twice he summoned the courage to ask if he could turn off the sprinkler, and twice he decided he could last if Lamar could. Maybe it helped. He checked his watch. Darkness was an hour and a half away.
"What about the accident?" Mitch finally asked. "We weren't told much.
They were scuba diving, and there was an explosion on the boat. The dive captain was also killed, a native of the islands. They're trying to get the bodies home now.
Where were their wives?
At home, thankfully. It was a business trip.
I can't picture Hodge.
Joe was a tall, blonde-headed guy who didn't say much. The kind you meet, but don't remember. He was a Harvard man, like yourself.
How old was he?
He and Marty were both 34. He would have made partner after Marty. They were very close. I guess we're all close, especially now. With all 10 fingernails, he combed his hair straight back. He stood and walked to dry ground. Water poured from his shirt tail and the cuffs of his pants. He stopped near Mitch and looked blankly at the treetops next door.
How's the BMW?
It's great. A fine car. Thanks for delivering it.
When did you arrive?
This morning. I've already put 300 miles on it.
Did the interior woman show up?
Yeah. She and Abby spent next year's salary.
That's nice. Nice house.
We're glad you're here, Mitch.
I'm just sorry about the circumstances.
You'll like it here.
You don't have to apologize.
I still don't believe it. I'm numb. Paralyzed. I shudder at the thought of seeing Marty's wife and the kids. I'd rather be lashed with a bullwhip than go over there.
The women appeared, walked across the wooden patio deck and down the steps to the pool. Kay found the faucet, and the sprinkler was silenced.
They left Chickasaw Gardens and drove west with the traffic toward downtown, into the fading sun. They held hands, but said little. Mitch opened the sunroof and rolled down the windows. Abby picked through a box of old cassettes and found Springsteen. The stereo worked fine. Hungry Heart blew from the windows as the little shiny roadster made its way toward the river. The warm, sticky, humid Memphis summer air settled in with the dark. Softball fields came to life as teams of fat men with tight polyester pants and lime green and fluorescent yellow shirts laid chalk lines and prepared to do battle. Cars full of teenagers crowded into fast food joints to drink beer and gossip and check out the opposite sex. Mitch began to smile. He tried to forget about Lamar and Kaczynski and Hodge. Why should he be sad? They were not his friends. He was sorry for their families, but he did not really know these people. And he, Mitchell Y. McDear, a poor kid with no family, had much to be happy about. Beautiful wife, new house, new car, new job, new Harvard degree. A brilliant mind and a solid body that did not gain weight and needed little sleep. $80,000 a year for now. In 2 years, he could be in six figures, and all he had to do was work 90 hours a week. Piece of cake. He pulled into a self-serve and pumped 15 gallons. He paid inside and bought a six-pack of Michelob. Abby opened two, and they darted back into the traffic. He was smiling now.
"Let's eat," he said.
"We're not exactly dressed," she said.
He stared at her long brown legs. She wore a white cotton skirt above the knees with a white cotton button-down. He had shorts, deck shoes, and a faded black polo.
"With legs like that, you could get us into any restaurant in New York."
"How about the rendezvous?" The dress seemed casual.
"Great idea." They paid to park in a lot downtown and walked 2 blocks to a narrow alley. The smell of barbecue mixed with the summer air and hung like a fog close to the pavement. The aroma filtered gently through the nose, mouth, and eyes and caused a rippling sensation deep in the stomach. Smoke poured into the alley from vents running underground into the massive ovens where the best pork ribs were barbecued in the best barbecue restaurant in a city known for world-class barbecue. The rendezvous was downstairs beneath the alley, beneath an ancient red brick building that would have been demolished decades earlier had it not been for the famous tenant in the basement. There was always a crowd and a waiting list, but Thursdays were slow, it seemed. They were led through the cavernous, sprawling, noisy restaurant and shown a small table with a red-checked tablecloth. There were stairs along the way. Always stairs. Men stopped eating, froze with ribs hanging from their teeth as Abby McDear glided by like a model on a runway. She had stopped traffic from a sidewalk in Boston. Whistles and catcalls were a way of life, and her husband was used to it. He took great pride in his beautiful wife. An angry black man with a red apron stood before them. "Okay, sir," he demanded. The menus were mats on the tables and completely unnecessary. Ribs, ribs, and ribs. 2 whole orders, cheese plate, pitcher of beer," Mitch shot back at him. The waiter wrote nothing but turned and screamed in the direction of the entrance, "Give me 2 whole, cheese, pitcher." When he left, Mitch grabbed her leg under the table. She slapped his hand. "You're beautiful," he said. "When was the last time I told you that you were beautiful?" "About 2 hours ago."
2 hours? How thoughtless of me.
"Don't let it happen again." He grabbed her leg again and rubbed the knee. She allowed it. She smiled seductively at him, dimples forming perfectly, teeth shining in the dim light, soft, pale brown eyes glowing. Her dark brunette hair was straight and fell perfectly a few inches below her shoulders. The beer arrived and the waiter filled 2 mugs without saying a word. Abby took a small drink and stopped smiling. "Do you think Lamar's okay?" she asked.
"I don't know. I thought at first he was drunk. I felt like an idiot sitting there watching him get soaked."
"Poor guy. Kay said the funerals will probably be Monday if they can get the bodies back in time.
Let's talk about something else. I don't like funerals, any funeral, even when I'm there out of respect and don't know the deceased. I've had some bad experiences with funerals."
The ribs arrived. They were served on paper plates with aluminum foil to catch the grease. A small dish of slaw and 1 of baked beans sat around a foot-long slab of dry ribs, sprinkled heavily with the secret sauce. They dug in with fingers.
"What would you like to talk about?" she asked.
"Getting pregnant."
"I thought we were going to wait a few years."
"We are. But I think we should practice diligently until then."
"We've practiced in every roadside motel between here and Boston."
"I know. But not in our new home." Mitch ripped 2 ribs apart, slinging sauce into his eyebrows.
"We just moved in this morning."
"I know. What are we waiting for?"
"Mitch, you act as though you've been neglected."
"I have, since this morning. I suggest we do it tonight, as soon as we get home, to sort of christen our new house."
"We'll see.
Is it a date?"
"Look, did you see that guy over there? He's about to break his neck trying to see some leg. I had to go over and whip his ass."
"Yes, it's a date. Don't worry about those guys. They're staring at you. They think you're cute."
"Very funny."
Mitch stripped his ribs clean and ate half of hers. When the beer was gone, he paid the check and they climbed into the alley. He drove carefully across town and found the name of a street he recognized from one of his many road trips of the day. After two wrong turns, he found Meadowbrook and then the home of Mr. and Mrs. Mitchell Y. McDear. The mattress and box springs were stacked on the floor of the master bedroom, surrounded by boxes. Hearsay hid under a lamp on the floor and watched as they practiced. 4 days later, on what should have been his first day behind his new desk, Mitch and his lovely wife joined the remaining 39 members of the firm and their lovely wives as they paid their last respects to Martin S. Kaczynski. The cathedral was full. Oliver Lambert offered a eulogy so eloquent and touching not even Mitchell McDear, who had buried a father and a brother, could resist chill bumps. Abby's eyes watered at the sight of the widow and the children. That afternoon, they met again in the Presbyterian Church in East Memphis to say farewell to Joseph M. Hodge. Chapter 5. The small lobby outside Royce McKnight's office was empty when Mitch arrived precisely at 8:30 on schedule. He hummed and coughed and began to wait anxiously. From behind two file cabinets, an ancient blue-haired secretary appeared and scowled in his general direction. When it was apparent he was not welcome, he introduced himself and explained he was to meet Mr. McKnight at this appointed hour. She smiled and introduced herself as Louise, Mr. McKnight's personal secretary, for 31 years now. "Coffee?" "Yes," he said, "black." She disappeared and returned with a cup and saucer. She notified her boss through the intercom and instructed Mitch to have a seat. She recognized him now. One of the other secretaries had pointed him out during the funerals yesterday. She apologized for the somber atmosphere around the place. No one felt like working, she explained, and it would be days before things were normal. They were such nice young men. The phone rang, and she explained that Mr. McKnight was in an important meeting and could not be disturbed. It rang again. She listened and escorted him into the managing partner's office. Oliver Lambert and Royce McKnight greeted Mitch and introduced him to two other partners, Victor Milligan and Avery Toller. They sat around a small conference table. Louise was sent for more coffee. Milligan was head of tax, and Toller, at 41, was one of the younger partners. "Mitch, we apologize for such a depressing beginning," McKnight said. "We appreciate your presence at the funerals yesterday, and we're sorry your first day as a member of our firm was one of such sadness." "I felt I belonged at the funerals," Mitch said. "We're very proud of you, and we have great plans for you. We've just lost two of our finest lawyers, both of whom did nothing but tax, so we'll be asking more of you. All of us will have to work a little harder." Louise arrived with a tray of coffee. Silver coffee server, fine china. "We are quite saddened," said Oliver Lambert. "So please, bear with us." They all nodded and frowned at the table. Royce McKnight looked at some notes on a legal pad. "Mitch, I think we've covered this before. At this firm, we assign each associate to a partner who acts as a supervisor and mentor. These relationships are very important. We try to match you with a partner with whom you will be compatible and able to work closely, and we're usually right. We have made mistakes, wrong chemistry or whatever, but when that happens, we simply reassign the associate. Avery Toller will be your partner." Mitch smiled awkwardly at his new partner. "You will be under his direction, and the cases and files you work on will be his. Virtually all of it will be tax work."
That's fine. Before I forget it, I'd like to have lunch today, Tolar said.
Certainly, Mitch said.
Take my limo, Mr. Lambert said.
I had planned to, said Tolar.
When do I get a limo?